Please introduce this, and we'll have our second reading from Psalm 9, which Annabelle is kindly going to read for us. Thank you, Annabelle.
The reading can be found on page 599 of the Pew Bibles. Psalm 90. A prayer of Moses, the man of God. Lord, you have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn men back to dust, saying, return to dust, O sons of men. For 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. You sweep men away in the sleep of death. They are like the new grass of the morning, though in the morning it springs up new, by evening it is dry and withered. We are consumed by your anger and terrified by your indignation. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. All our days pass away under your wrath. We finish our years with a moan. The length of our days is 70 years, or 80 if we have the strength. Yet their span is but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away. Who knows the power of your anger? For your wrath is as great as the fear that is due to you. Teach us to number our days aright, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Relent, O Lord. How long will it be? Have compassion on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, for as many years as we have seen trouble. May your deeds be shown to your servants, your splendour to their children. May the favour of the Lord our God rest upon us. Establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Thank you very much, Annabelle. Let's just pray together, shall we? I thought, as you think about this psalm, would you direct our thinking, help us to understand more of you, and to put our confidence in you, for Jesus' sake. Amen. Well, on Remembrance Sunday, we traditionally sing, O God, our help in ages past, a hymn written long ago by Isaac Watts. And you may ask, well, why do we sing that? Well, it's very moving, isn't it? It's a plea to God, who's helped us in the past, and is to help us in the future, whether in war or in peace. But I wonder if you've noticed the repetition in the first and last verse of that phrase, our eternal home. Because it's not just a plea for help, an expression of hope, but indeed an expression of where we're actually at, resting in God as our eternal home. And so I wanted to focus on Psalm 90 this morning, which is the very psalm upon which that hymn is based. Be thou our guard while life shall last, or in the modern version, while troubles last, it is, and our eternal home. Home. Well, that's a sentimental idea in a way, isn't it? You all, I suspect, familiar with the keep the home fires burning. This may ring bells with you. Keep the home fires burning while your hearts are yearning. Though your lads are far away, they dream of home. There's a silver lining through the dark clouds shining. Turn the dark clouds inside out till the boys come home. Home. It's a word redolent of warmth, isn't it, of security. And in time of war, soldiers think of home, both as the reason for which they fight, to protect home and family, and also as the place they want to be, a place of joy and love and peace. And then you ask the question, where is home? If you think about Ukraine at present, many homes have been destroyed, are still being destroyed, and will be destroyed, just as they were in the Blitz in London. And of course, home is not simply a physical place, is it? It's not so much a physical place as a representation of the people for whom we care and who care for us. A place that represents joy and comfort and peace and security and love. And yet, just in the same way as we move home, home is not simply a place. When you think about it, people are transient too. The people with whom we share this sense of home move on. Time passes. Parents die. Brothers and sisters move away, live far away. Children move out. Things change. And we all move inexorably towards death. Whether in war, as a result of COVID or cancer, or simply as our bodies wear out. And Psalm 90 reminds us of two plain and inescapable facts which war perhaps impresses on us, as does an epidemic. The first is simply the permanence of God. And the second is the fleeting nature of human life. And then there are some conclusions to be drawn from that. Conclusions which should drive our thinking about life as the children of dust that we are. You will have noticed in Rupert Brooke's poem the reference to dust. A richer dust concealed in that which earth, and so on. Children of dust. The psalm that we have in Psalm 90 is ascribed to Moses, who probably reflected on all those who died who never made it to the promised land, as he himself didn't. They died after wandering nomadically around the desert for a generation, living in tents with no fixed abode. And life ended for them without them ever getting to the home that they had been promised, the promised land, getting where they'd hoped to get to in their lives. True for most of us, I suspect. I think now and again of Cecil T. Rhodes, a man who brought half of Africa into the British Empire. What were his dying words, do you know? So little done, so much to do. Extraordinary when you think about it. And then, of course, you think of your own life and what that has achieved. So first, the permanence of God. God is God. And we can see how God is described in verse 2 of Psalm 90. Not only was he there before the mountains were formed, but before the world was made, before the universe came into being. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. And then verse 4 says, 1,000 years in his sight are like an evening gone, just like a few hours to us. And the whole sweep of history, if you think about it, from the invasion of the Normans in 1066 through to today, it's just like a few hours past for him. Or Israel's whole history. Think of that. 400 years in Egypt, wandering in the desert, living in Israel for a bit, exiled, and then, of course, following the Roman destruction of Jerusalem, 1,800 years in the diaspora until 1948. And what Moses is saying is this, that throughout all the wanderings of Israel and their problems and their straying from God and his ways, that God was God and Israel's true home was not the land that he promised to give them, but the Lord himself. You have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Throughout all the years of wandering and exile, he was to be their focus, their true home, consisted in the love, joy, comfort, and security to be found with being at home with him. With him. The permanence of God, our eternal home. And then secondly, the fleeting nature of human life. We know enough of that, I think, from our own experience, because we encounter change all the time. We encounter worry and grief and pain and suffering and death in what is often described as this veil of tears. That's not to say, of course, there's no joy. There plainly is. But the overall picture for many is a hard life, a tough life. 70 years, maybe 80 if you hang out that long. And as described in the psalm, their span is but trouble and sorrow. It's hard work. The years quickly pass and we fade away. I don't know whether you have thought and even ordered for yourself a tombstone to go in the churchyard. Perhaps even thought about the epitaph you'd like to have on it. But just look at those that have been there for some 70 years or more. I'm afraid they're mostly uncared for and forgotten. There's some words on them recording the life of someone who was loved. But what is there to show for their fleeting existence? What will yours say? Even those who were famous in their time, I wonder how many of you have had a look at the bust behind the organ here. It's quite famous if you look in books about church architecture. There's a man up there whose bust there, called Sir John Lade. Very famous in his time. But if I asked you if you could tell me one significant thing that he achieved in his life, you'd probably be struggling. And so indeed would I. We're like the grass that springs up at the beginning of the day but is dead by the end of it in a hot climate. The permanence of God and the fleeting nature of man and all his activities and achievements is blindly obvious when you stop to think about it. And so we get to the conclusions to be drawn. Well, we shouldn't be left with any delusions of self-importance, should we, at this stage? But is that all there is that this has to say to us? Eternal God and passing man, short life. No, because there's a reason why things are the way they are in this life. We don't die simply because that's the nature of the world and creation. I wonder if you noticed verse 3. It's God who turns us back to dust. He says, return to dust, O sons of men. And that echoes Genesis chapter 3, doesn't it? With God's sentence on Adam, the word Adam, as you probably know, sounds in Hebrew like the word for dust or earth. Return to dust, O sons of men. And what does God say to Adam after Adam and Eve have gone their own way rather than his? Through painful toil and by the sweat of your brow, you'll eat the fruit of the ground until you return to it, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and unto dust you will return. And the reason that life is as it is, and why we experience turmoil and trouble and toil and pain and death, is because of humanity's fight against God. And we're under sentence. Because he made humanity to be at home with him. And we have chosen to live independently from him. Dust to dust, ashes to ashes, unless our eternal home is with him. James chapter 4 told us that fightings and war stem from the desire to have something, to want something. And wars and its evils are an obvious result of man's rejection of God and the sentence imposed on man. That's the way you want to go. That's the consequence. Death, destruction, mayhem, chaos. We're in a world where death is inevitable as the consequence of humanity leaving God out. In the day you eat, said God to Adam, talking of the forbidden fruit, in the day you eat of it, you shall surely die. And so we have in verse 7 in this psalm, you sweep men away in the sleep of death. We're consumed by your anger and terrified by your indignation. You set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. All our days pass away under your wrath. and our years end with a sigh or a moan, depending on the translation. What's the point? There are no secrets hidden from God. He sees it all. He sees exactly what's going through our minds. There's nothing we can hide from him. None of our prodigal wanderings away from him, from the God to whom we belong. He knows. And if that doesn't fill you with a certain apprehension, well, perhaps it should. Because where we are reflects the sentence, the judgment of God on us, in a world that chooses to go its own way and reaps the consequences, whether individually, collectively, in families, in nations, or globally. The world is skewed. And in these circumstances, the writer concludes, who knows, who understands the power of your wrath? Your wrath is as great as the fear that's due to you. We have reason to be apprehensive. Well, all that's pretty miserable, isn't it? A miserable commentary on life. A veil of tears as life rushing by and ending with a sigh or moan as we return to dust. But the point is not simply that that's what life is like. Because if you know the reason, if you understand why it is the way it is, you can then see that God himself can do something about it. And what the prayer in verse 12 says, and I wonder if you picked this up, teach us to number our days aright that we may gain a heart of wisdom. It's not just saying, help us to count the calendar. Anybody can do that and work out that they're not living a huge length of time in comparison with eternity. It's not just help us to see we've got limited time as compared with the Lord of eternity. But it's asking for wisdom to use our time well, to get wise about God and with God in the context of time and eternity. Teach us to number our days aright that we may gain a heart of wisdom. And then in verse 13, Moses asks God to relent. How long is it going to be, he says. Relent. And in some translations, rather better translations, I think, it's actually return rather than relent. Return, relent, have compassion on your servants. Be merciful to us. And instead of him saying, return to dust, O sons of men, we say to him, return to us. Show compassion on us. Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love. Do you see what that's about? Give us a new beginning in a new day, in a new morning. Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love so that we can sing for joy and be glad all our days and see as many days of joy and gladness as we have seen trouble. And so the contrast is between the early verses of the psalm where we're thought of as grass that is dead by the evening after a troubled life, and a new morning, a new day where God's unfailing love reaches us and gives us joy. How can that be? Well, of course, we come from this from a New Testament perspective. But we see what's said here. We're told here it's because of what the Lord does, not because of anything we can do. In verse 16, Moses asks that what the Lord has done will be made known to the children of those dying in the wilderness, no doubt, before they reach the promised land. And what has God done for those people? They needed to see what God had done in bringing them out of Egypt. God had delivered them. God had caused the angel of death to pass over them with the blood of the Lamb on the lintel and the doorposts. God had delivered them from the bondage of slavery in Egypt. And the picture that we have in the psalm is, of course, of what Jesus did in dying for us, the Lamb of God who takes the judgment of God on himself in our place. So although the psalmist wouldn't have seen that clearly, we can clearly see that. He could see the deliverance from Egypt. We can see the deliverance from sin and death on the cross. And what does the psalmist do in that light of that? he says in the words of verse 17, he says, may the favour of the Lord our God rest upon us. He wants the Lord to turn and have compassion and be gracious and merciful and look favourably on his people. And at that point it crossed my mind that the classic example that Jesus gives in his parable in the New Testament is of the two men who go up to the temple to pray. You remember the story? There's the Pharisee and there's the tax collector. The highly religious man and the one who sold out to the Romans and is part of the collaboration movement in collecting taxes for them and making a little mint on the side for himself. And the Pharisee is self-confident and considers that God ought to think well of him because of all he does. And the tax collector, by contrast, knows his true status before God and simply says in his broken state, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And what does Jesus say? He says the tax collector got it right and went away right with God, not the Pharisee. And that really knows where this psalm should take us to, I think. To cast ourselves on the grace and mercy of God in the troubled and warring world in which we live. To see him as our eternal home, to whom we're headed, and on whom we rely, and in whom we find our peace and our joy and security. And if that's our focus, if that's the way we're living, then our lives will actually count for something, notwithstanding whatever is going to appear on your epitaph on the tombstone. The lives of those who fought and died for the freedom of their homes did count for something. We can see that in the world, the land in which we now live. But more importantly still, if God's favour rests on us, then everything that we do counts, because we do it for him. However small, our lives, which may seem insignificant, if they're lived for him, count for him. The words of verse 17, you see the author understands this. He asks for God to establish the work of his hands. It may be meaningful, it may achieve something, it may be significant in the context of a fleeting human life and eternity. We can ask him, in the words of verse 17, to establish the work of our hand, to make something of our lives that they may count for him. In the old prayer book, we used to pray, Lord, have mercy upon us, and the response of the congregation was, and grant us thy salvation. If that's what we're looking for, if that's what we're about, if God is our eternal home, then when we truly get home, when we get to our true home, we know very well what he'll say, because he tells us. He'll say, well done, you good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your Lord. So if we may we bow our heads, and I'm going to pray using some of the words of these very verses. Lord, teach us to number our days aright, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. May your favour, the favour of the Lord our God, rest upon us. Establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands because of Jesus and for his name's sake. Amen.